Coming up on this episode of Mac Break Weekly, Andy Annotko, Chris Breen, and Ken Ray all join me. We're going to talk about all sorts of stuff. What's new at CES this week? Apple isn't there, but everybody's talking about Apple. Plus those Waze rumors. What do we make of all that stuff? App Store milestones, boy, they're in the billions now. Tim Cook keeps going to China. What's up with that? And a lot more up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 332, recorded January 8th, 2013. Crazy, stupid, big. This episode of Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Lantronics, maker of the XPrint server. Print from your iPad, iPhone, or any iOS device to virtually any printer. For more information, visit xprintserver.com/twit and enter the code TWIT to receive free shipping on your order. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your iPhone, iPad, MacBook, or Android smartphone. Find out what your gadget is worth and get cash to upgrade to the latest phone at gazelle.com. And by Pond5, the world's stock media marketplace. If you're a media maker looking for video, photos, illustrations, music, sound effects, After Effects templates, or 3D models, check out Pond5. And for exclusive 50 free stock media files, go to pond5.com/macbreak. And by audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/macbreak. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a wonderful episode of Mac Break Weekly, a CES episode, kind of, even though Apple isn't there and never is. We're on episode 331. Leo is at CES, actually, which is why I get to be in Leo's chair for the show. So thanks for joining me. I will now introduce my illustrious panel of experts who will help me get through this show, because I've been paying so much attention to CES that I really don't know what's going on in the world of Apple. Starting, of course, with Andy Annotko. Hello, Andy.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for joining us. Andy, of course, tech columnist over at the Chicago Sun-Times and a Mac Break Weekly regular. Also, Christopher Breen, senior editor over at Macworld. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Sarah. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for being on the show. And Ken Ray, host and producer at Mac OS Ken.
Hello, Sarah. How are you?
Very well, thanks. So before the show, I noticed that we all looked pretty comfortable in our little areas. We got books behind us. Nobody's in a hotel room. None of us are at CES this year.
That's right. You're like the Secretary of Agriculture, where like Leo goes out to give the big address. In case there's a nuclear strike upon the facility, you will survive in order to take over the reins of this week in technology. So it's a very, very important thing. And the fact that we're here in our climate controlled bunkers, not being exposed to deadly toxins, not being exposed to Cirque du Soleil, able to simply sit here comfortably and really watch every single one of piece of these newses with what I'm sure you're all set up like I am, like in at my office during CES week is set up with like multiple screens everywhere, so that at any given moment I could be watching like a keynote presentation on one screen. Like LG came out with a whole kinds of really dog, pony, and monkey show last night, so I could be watching that while writing about it on another screen, while watching someone else's live blog of another event on another screen, and again, meanwhile, there's available of adorable beverages. All in all, a much better alternative, I think, to being in Las Vegas and being in the desert. In the desert, who volunteers to go to the desert? Nobody.
Well, wait a second, Andy. You were going to CES. You weren't even going to be there. Turns out that you're not. So it's easy to say who'd ever want to go, but you were going.
Well, let me put it this way. Like my Las Vegas privileges were revoked because of my platinum double diamond card counting scheme that caused me to be the most successful professional gambler on the Strip or adjacent to the Strip, which is why with one simple 800 number to my website, you too can get the secrets to double dealing, counting, double diamond blackjack to get you banned from every casino in Las Vegas, just like Andy, the province. And APCO.
Chris, what do you make of CES year after year? I think there's probably more naysayers, or at least the more vocal naysayers on the blogs talking about how CES is, it's a hardware show in a world of software. From the Macworld side of things, do you think it's important to still attend?
You know, I've gone a couple of times, and basically I think of CES as a hellhole, and a never-ending hellhole. So if you try to go there as you're covering a smaller show and walk the floor, it's impossible. So you really have to know what you're going to see and pick your spots. For people who are interested in Apple, Apple's influence is all over these things, even though they don't attend. So you kind of see, even this year, people doing more things that are related to iOS, and they're incorporating them into their hardware or whatever their next big plan is, or their social networking scheme, or whatever they're pushing. So Apple is represented in a way there, but it is so big, it's so difficult to cover, and so much of the stuff is like going to a it's like going to one of these auto shows where they have these tremendous looking cars that you'll never be able to afford, and they're never going to be released anyway, but still... Samsung can release the 87-inch easel-mounted television that nobody will ever own and probably will never produce. But at least you can go there and gawk at it and go, oh, wow, that is really great. And then when that wears off, you realize this is something I'm never going to be able to afford or use. So nice prototype, but what have you got for me now? And a lot of times there isn't much. What you do instead are look for trends. Like 2 years ago, it was 3D TVs. How many of us have 3D TVs?
Not very many. I don't.
Right. Yeah. And we would be the people that would have them, right? But we don't. So I mean, that sort of tells you what CES is about. It's they're marketing to the future and saying this is what's going to be happening or what we would like to happen. But it still relies on the consumer saying, good idea. So like for a 4K TV, good idea, but expensive. Are people really going to buy into this thing? Perhaps not.
Ken Ray, what do you make of CES? We've got folks in the chat room saying, oh, it's slam CES show because, of course, MacBreak Weekly, you know, the Apples, and, you know, they don't go to CES. So do you get anything out of it? Do you feel like, Chris, that it's kind of a mess?
Sadly, I've never been, and I'm not as jaded as some people. I would love to go.
Oh.
I would gladly go to Vegas anytime, actually. So, you know, if you're looking to take somebody along. what's weird to me about this year for CES is it feels like one of the first years in a long time where there wasn't like one Apple thing talking about it. I know there are articles saying that everything's tying into iOS as well as to Android. But last year, Apple was going to be doing something at the end of January, which turned out to be their education event. Of course, a couple of years ago, it was the iPad 2. And then before that, it was the iPad, which we didn't even know what it was going to be. Although that's when Ballmer did his big, you know, CES speech saying, look, we got tablets too, which eventually ended up being true. Is it a mess? I mean, Apple did the whole thing a few years ago where they quit going to Macworld, right? I mean, it's sort of questionable how necessary the things are, but I would love to be the guy to go there and gawk at the stuff, even if it's a lot of stuff that you're never going to see or that you're not going to see anytime soon. And it's fun to read the stories about the things that you know aren't going to happen. Like the big, what was the one? Is it, who's got the tablet right now that's like 27
Lenovo.
Inches?
Oh, Lenovo, yeah. It's the...
Yeah, which, I mean...
The big old, like with the smart dice, and it's... There's a lot going on.
It looks like it might be kind of a fun thing, but the best thing was the picture that they have of the mom lugging it. I mean, she's like, it looks like she could drop it any second, and it's supposed to look like this convenient thing to move from place to place. It's a 27-inch tablet.
Well, and I think the battery life, it maxes out at about 2 hours, so awesome. It's not that portable.
Well, maybe it's not designed exclusively to be used in the park for doing homework on. Maybe it's, you could imagine like putting this just on the coffee table and just letting the kids play with it for like 4 hours. I mean, you think they get immersed in Dora the Explorer? Give them an interactive tablet that is about as big as their entire bodies are. I think that's pretty interesting stuff. But yeah, I mean that is typical of the sort of new that you get out of CS. I don't think that it's a nothing show. I don't think that it's not important. But as Chris said, as a person who covers technology, It's avoidable only in the sense that you have to go there with a really clear agenda of exactly what you want to cover and exactly who you're going to be meeting with and exactly what you're going to be seeing. Because it's not only things, it's frustrating because I have an On the Outliner document right here in front of me of all the stuff that I want to follow up on with engineers and PR people that I happen to know at these companies. And the frustrating thing is that Canon will show off this incredibly really cool, what really feels like a next generation camera that is designed almost specifically to be the better camera than your smartphone, where the idea is that you're going to be using this camera because it has the great lens, it has the zoom, it has the really good image sensor, it has the really good flash. But ultimately, soon after you click the shutter, it's going to send that photo to your iPad or to your iPhone, and that's where you're going to edit it, or that's where you're going to triage it, or that's where it's going to post it from. It's like, wow, that's wonderful. When's it ship? We don't know. How much is it going to cost? We can't tell you.
Oh.
So yeah, there is you go to the auto show. You're really cool. You're really immensely taken in by this entirely made out of pre-processed styrofoam that gets a car that gets 800 miles to the gallon. And then you read the fine print, realize no, we just built this up so that people would come to our booth and we could tell them all about our new gear shift knob that we're actually putting into our new Impala. So it's, you have to be very selective about how you treat the information that comes out of there.
You know, in years past, Go ahead, Chris.
Well, I was just going to say really quickly, I apologize. It reminds me of the first time I went to the National Association of Broadcasters Convention in 1999. I think that was the first time I actually saw HD video or HD, like an HD monitor in person. It was about as big as the 13-inch MacBook Pro screen that I'm looking at right now. And I didn't actually own my first HD TV until 2008. So I mean, there may be a little bit of that going on as well. You might not see that particular Canon device, but you do sort of get a glimpse of the future. But I mean, it's sort of like I said a minute ago, I'm sort of a slack-jawed yokel when I go to these things. I mean, I don't know exactly when the next products are going to come out, but it is sort of neat to see different visions of the future, even if the future that's being presented right there is not the one that you're going to get. The weird thing right now as far as Apple stuff seems to be, from the stories that I've read, is almost nobody's got Lightning yet. So you're looking at a bunch of demo devices that go along with the older 30-pin dock connector, which is kind of cool because there are still a lot of 30-pin dock connectors out there, a lot of devices that use them. I had two. There's an iPhone 4 kicking around the house, obviously, that still uses them as well. But you've sort of been this weird place of, hey, this is the future for this past device, at least as far as Apple devices are concerned. But one assumes that they'll catch up with the MF. I made for I thing designation.
Well, we're talking about trends, right, at CES. And in years past, Leo and I have actually had a really good time walking the area of whatever hall it is, the floor that's all sort of iDevice, third-party manufacturers. You know, you got these, some of the stuff is sort of wacky and junky. Some of it is really cool. You have a lot of case makers and creative types. And that's always sort of been the fun part for me, even though Apple is not present. You know that people from Apple are there taking a look around, sniffing around. All the big companies are. And it's sort of, there's a chance for some of the little guys to get a little bit more attention. So in years past, obviously, and then you go to Macworld after that and you see quite a bit of overlap. Not having been at CES this year, I think it'll be even more fun to be at Macworld because some of the stuff I'll be seeing for the first time. But it's not as if you don't see how the Apple ecosystem is evolving while you're at a place like CES. It's just happening kind of in a back channel way.
Well, yeah, I Lounge a couple of years ago, I think it's 3 years ago now, established iLounge Pavilion. And they were very smart about it, that they saw that CES was such a massive show and everything was spread out. And really, it's these enormous halls and multiple buildings. And the iLounge folks, I think, came in and talked to CES and said, look, there are people that are very interested in Apple's ecosystem, and it makes no sense to have it scattered across 75 hectares. What we should do instead is create this area within one of the halls, and we'll call it the iLounge Pavilion. And you can go through, and there'll be 75 to 150 vendors there where it's only iOS related and Apple related stuff. And as you say, there are a lot of cases there which, you know, it's marginally interesting. But there are the occasional battery packs in there and some other iOS accessories. So you can go there if you're sort of Apple centric. You're not going to get software and that sort of thing. But if you miss the old days of Macworld Expo, where it was an entire hall dedicated to case manufacturers and doodads for your iOS devices, you can get it at CES, which is brilliant. I'm so glad that they did it. So you can focus if you want on that area, but it's good for about 2 or 3 hours, and then you have the rest of the show to deal with.
It's true. You know, Chris, you mentioned that Samsung 4K TV. I mean, 4K is the big thing at CES now. Forget the Apple TV. Everybody's doing 4K. And I know that this is Samsung, but I mean, let's just call Samsung and Apple big old rivals these days. So let's talk about one of Apple's rivals. They've come out 4K TV. It's 85 inches. It's the UN85S9. They call it the world's largest ultra high definition TV. That's the new thing now. 4K confuses people, so they say it's ultra HD. That sounds good, right? It's like HD, but better. And this thing is weird. It's sort of on an easel. It's extremely thin. People who are at the show say, "Wow, the floating effect is really amazing. It's really beautiful." Well, I don't know. Maybe it just doesn't come across in pictures. It looks pretty clunky to me. You've got this. I don't know. I've been very perplexed by this, and I would love to know what you gentlemen think. Is this actually something that's they're going to sell it this way? I can't imagine that would be the case. What about people who want to mount their TVs on a wall? Apparently, The Verge said, at least from what they can tell, at least on this prototype, this is not something you can take the TV out of. It's easel or it's nothing.
This is a device that you build your house around. I mean, really, it's
you're
so
have
big
to for the
that
price.
You can't just... Yeah, you can't bring it into your house. You really have to say, okay, either I have a McMansion with a media center room that's enormous, and this will be great in here, and I have more money than God, and it's okay that I do this. Or you just say, I love this TV. Let me go buy a bigger house for it. and again, I think this is more car show stuff. It's like, look, we can build something like this. It's monstrous. Maybe we'll sell some. I don't know. I don't know who needs an 85-inch TV, unless you want that sort of, you know, it's a corporate media room, or again, you've got the basement media room and you want to really impress people and you have the theater seating and the popcorn that comes directly from, you know, a small vendor in France.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why CES products is so interesting, that when you get at the technology this early on, you're dealing with a very special kind of consumer, that there are people who are going to want to buy the 1 million inch diagonal display that's about 3 microns thick and requires a special sort of floor stand easel in order to go. I think it was Bang & Olufsen, famously last year or the year before, had a screen that was on a special like robotic gimbaled mount so that it would adjust itself as you move about the room, so that's at your perfect eye level. So it's, you'll always find people, like, you know, people who might play basketball for a living, might have won 8 or 9 Masters tournaments, that kind of consumer, who will buy those things. And so it's a flashy thing for them to produce because it's a flashy thing to acquire. The interesting thing, though, really comes when 2 or 3, 4, 5 years down the line, when you have to figure out how to get a 4K set that makes sense for consumers, people who not necessarily are the people who are buying $300 TV sets at Walmart, who maybe want to treat themselves to a nice set, but still can't get something that's completely impractical. Sony had a couple press releases where buried down 2 or 3 levels, announcements deep, is here is our plan for delivering 4K movies to people. Here is a special box we're going to be able to provide. Here are the deals that we've made with a couple of different studios to provide select titles to consumers. So really, we're at that stage where it's definitely a demo type technology, only now it's sophisticated enough that it's a demo technology that a consumer can actually buy, of really rich, again, someone who probably plays some sort of athletic thing for a living or is at least indirectly responsible for the financial collapse of the early 2010s.
Can I tell you the weird thing about it to me?
Yeah.
You got 85 inches of screen, 4 HDMI input.
Well,
you would think that there would be enough room for maybe 5 or 6, because in my house, I could max out the 4 HDMI inputs if I wanted to. So it's kind of weird to me that you're going to have this, you know, TV that's bigger than most of the walls in my living room.
What uses those 4 HDMI inputs if you have to choose? You've got the 85 inch TV and now you have to choose.
I'm sorry, say again?
What's going to be plugged into those 4 inputs? you've got the 85-inch TV and that's all you've got, what makes the cut?
Well, I guess, let's see. There's my Apple TV. There's my cable box, because my cable box goes that way, so that's two, right? My game system, which I'm actually upgrading, and I may have been kidding about actually having all four. I could max out the fourth because I do want a Roku box as well, because as cool as my Apple TV is as far as doing AirPlay and things like that, there's more offered in the Roku box. So if I was willing to, you know, fork out the $79, then I could actually max them all out. But I was being a tiny bit facetious. Okay.
Well, then there's your VCR with the adapter on it. So you want to have your RCA connectors going out to the HDMI converter and upscale, because this thing apparently is really good at upscaling. So those VCR tapes from the early 80s are going to look fantastic.
All VHS and 4K. Never seen anything so nice.
Oh, yeah. I understand that little brick out from an Apple II Plus is trace elegant. Although that's it. I wonder if it's really designed to be switched between four inputs, because I know of exactly one person, one fellow human that I know who owns one of these TV sets, and he says that the only really way to use it effectively is to have it has a mode where you can just treat it as four 1080p screens in the same display, and so you basically can have all three Lord of the Rings movies plus The Hobbit playing in HD at the same time, which once again is kind of a nice demo. I'm not sure if it's any less confusing if you're watching all four at the same time, but these are things you can get away with when you're just selling for bragging rights, I guess.
All right, let's take a little break. Let everybody catch their breath. There's been a lot of CES talk. In fact, there's a little bit more, but we're going to keep it a little bit more Apple-focused right after we talk about Lantronix's XPrint server. This thing is amazing, because if you've ever been in a situation where you've got an iPhone or an iPad and you want to print something, and then it gets really complicated because your printer is not compatible, and then you got to send it to your computer, and it's just a mess, right? That's not the point of tablets. That's not the point of portability. The XPrint server enables wireless printing from your iPad, your iPhone, your iPod Touch. This is what it looks like. It looks like an Apple product, right? It is a tiny little guy, eliminates the need to print through apps or install extra software that can be cumbersome, or email yourself documents. I know you've all done it, because I've done the same thing. Works with the USB or network printer that you already own, whether it is wired or not. Wireless works too. So it supports more than 4,000 top brand network printers. So there's a very, very, very high chance that your printer is one of those. Easy to use, automatic discovery and setup of printers. You basically open up the box, you plug in your Lantronix XPrint server, and you print. Advanced configuration available via web interface, so you can do quite a bit of tinkering around. What's nice is that one of these guys, one XPrint server, supports multiple printers and virtually unlimited iOS devices as well. So if you've got a bunch in your house, don't worry about it. It will be supported. There's two different little editions here. We got a home edition that's $99. It supports up to 8 USB and 2 network printers. Then there's the office edition, which might make a lot more sense to those of us who have got quite a few devices to deal with in an office with a lot of people and a lot of iPads. $199 for the office edition. Supports up to 8 USB and unlimited network printers. Allows your USB printers to be shared with users all across the network. And it's good for a home. It's very good for an office. Hey, you know, offices are cluttered. It even works with large multifunction printers. So again, you're in an area with a lot of folks and people are just printing left and right. This is a really, really, really good solution that makes a lot more sense than upgrading a bunch of printers. If you've got printers that work in all other capacities, then this Lantronix makes so much more sense than starting from scratch. So if you go to xprintserver.com/twit, so that's the letter X, printserver.com/twit, you can get a little bit more information, and of course you can buy from there as well. We have a special offer for you. Use the code TWIT and you'll receive free shipping on your order. Hey, yeah, all you have to do is buy your little device. You don't have to pay for shipping. Remember, xprintserver.com/twit, and at checkout, enter the code TWIT for free shipping. Won't cost you a dime. And thanks to Lantronix, for sponsoring this episode of MacBreak Weekly. All right, gentlemen. So I did say before the break that we were going to talk about CES a little bit more, but I think this is kind of pretty cool. CarTech, Hyundai says its upcoming vehicles will integrate Siri eyes-free technology. This was something that was announced over at CES, the Consumer Electronics Show happening in Las Vegas this week, known as the CES pool by some. Siri eyes-free technology allows you, as the name implies, to take calls, create reminders, all hands-free, without having to look down, take your hands off the wheel. And I wanted to get everyone's opinion about if Hyundai, you know, this is a pretty big brand. Hyundai has become a much more respected, I think, automobile brand in recent years. Does this bring them up to some sort of an echelon like a BMW or a Mercedes or an Audi or a Land Rover, which were all companies that Apple announced would be partners when they announced Siri eyes-free technology at the WWDC last June? Andy, I'll start with you.
Well, I'm not really sure. I mean, CES announcements, there are all kinds of partnerships that are announced. Sony, remember when Google TV was first set out, Sony said, oh, we're really committing to Google TV. We're producing these three models that have it. The question is, are they actually going to, do they think it's so important they're going to be putting it all across the entire line? I'm not aware that they've made a commitment to support Siri pretty much everywhere. If it's something that they're going to use to differentiate their luxury cars from their non-luxury cars, it's not quite so important. I mean, the big deal is when something like Bluetooth becomes so important that it becomes sort of a mainstream feature that they put in everywhere. I know it's not the same analogy because they have the Bluetooth is a more open standard, but you know what I'm talking about. I would be much more impressed if this weren't just sort of an outside sort of feature that they'd feel as though they can charge extra for premium content. But I mean, the fact that the iPhone is a best-selling phone in the country means that it's something that people are going to want. So yeah, it does say something about the presence of iOS, at least in the automotive world.
That's a really interesting idea, though. Your question was, does it raise up Hyundai, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of, I mean, that's just the fact that you're asking, just the fact that you're asking that question is kind of neat. I mean, because when I first read it, my thought was sort of like what Andy's saying. I mean, what's really going to be neat is when you can get in any car and you don't have to worry. You just, you know, all of them have the eyes free with Siri, but it's kind of a neat idea that including the iOS integration actually raises Hyundai stock rather than, you know, whether being in more cars raises iOS stock.
Chris, what do you think? Is this a way for Hyundai cars to just be that much more expensive with technology that is interesting but not necessarily worth the price?
Yeah, I think possibly. It's you know, I think it's a nice thing, like Andy says. It's becoming kind of a standard, although not as open as Bluetooth. But I think people do expect, if they've got these kind of features built into their phone, and Siri navigation makes so much sense, but if you try to use it on the phone, you'll get killed. So to have it built into your automobile is a no-brainer. And I think Apple's always had a history of having whoever does their marketing with the or their work with the automobile companies has done a really good job. So they wanted to make sure that was done with the iPod. I think this is the next logical step, that Apple then goes back to these auto manufacturers and said, look, this is something that people are going to want. It would be great if it would interface with your nav systems that you're building into your cars already. And it's only going to cost you, you know, X number of dollars. I think that it does help car companies distinguish themselves. Hyundai being in the second tier instead of the first, I'm sure, is a disappointment to them. But the fact that they are in the second tier instead of the third, fourth, or fifth tier bodes well for them. They're selling a lot of cars, and I think that's one of the things that Apple's interested in, is getting more of this technology into more cars. So while it's great to have the brand recognition of a BMW or a Land Rover, that's not what the majority of people are driving. They're driving Toyotas, they're driving Hyundais, they're driving, not Datsuns anymore, but Fords, for example. But yeah, so I think this is just Apple trying to get this technology in and make it more and more of a standard. Once they do that, they can expand it into other markets.
All right, another, I loved this headline. This is from Cult of Mac about lightning accessories, and I'll read it. Where the hell are all the lightning accessories at CES? That's Cult of Mac saying it's CES. This is the hardware convention, right? Everyone says, yeah, we're living in a software world. Well, CES is the place where accessories like this will really shine. And they said, well, you know, you get a few exhibitors who say, yeah, we've got, you know, lighting accessories, or here's a prototype. We're working on it. No dates, TBD, but they're not really products. And this is, you know, the lightning connector we were introduced to. When was the iPhone announcement? It was September, right? We've had time. What's the deal?
Well, except they only had their made for iPhone or their made MFI developer event in late November, I think. It was second half of November anyway. So it's only been a few months that they actually had to, you know, get together and really work with that thing, right?
Apparently someone from Cult of Mac, who's John Brownlee, who wrote this article, said he talked to a couple representatives with lightning accessories that they couldn't show off. And they said Apple was withholding lightning from them until April, so that there are lightning accessories at the show, but just from, you know, the big Apple partners, Belkin, that sort of, you know, big companies that have better relationships with Apple. I'm pretty surprised, I guess, that we haven't seen more of this, because the whole thing about lightning and the docks changing that upset me was just that I've got all these, you know, I've got this neat alarm clock now and doesn't work anymore with my phone. I can't dock it and it'll track my sleep. And, you know, that sort of stuff, like the third party products, that's the fun stuff. And you just, it's been a little lackluster, at least from what I'm hearing.
Well, this is very much left up to Apple, in that this is an extension of like the old made for iPod program, where Apple has that proprietary connector. It was the 30-pin connector before, and now it's the Lightning connector. So I think what some people don't understand is that Apple gets money from anybody who uses the Lightning connector. So they're licensing that connector as well. So not only do you have to be part of the made for iDevice program, but then you have to pay a tariff for each one of these devices that uses the Lightning connector. So part of it is that Apple has already made the deals with the big companies and said, here's the pound of flesh we're going to take from you in order for you to use Lightning. These deals still have to be made with third parties. And for some of them, they simply can't do it. It's too expensive. So they have chosen to recommend that people use Apple's adapter with it, or hopefully someone like Monoprice can get into the market and license Lightning from them and then be able to sell adapters and connectors less expensively than Apple does. I don't know why Apple would do that, because, again, they own the thing and they can make premium profit from doing that. But really, it's a lot about licensing and how much people have to pay Apple for that connector.
It's kind of surprising, though, that we don't at least see a show of force there on the show floor. Thunderbolt, that's understandable, because manufacturers really have the option of either supporting it or not supporting it. And, you know, as we all know, they're really not supporting it. Whereas Lightning, that's going to be on every single iPad and every single phone. And it really, there's nothing that's going to prevent it from being a huge standard that any accessory manufacturer is going to have to support. So it just seems a little bit weird that they wouldn't, given that CES is all about promises and no expectation of follow through. I mean, Microsoft is or was legendary for having their CEO hold up a product where the Microsoft logo is just a sticker that was put on there 4 hours ago, which was the point at which this prototype was finished, not really having any desire to do anything but show off something shiny and then see how people react to it. I mean, there's nothing, it costs them nothing to simply think, we really definitely do want to do a version of this MIDI keyboard as a Lightning accessory. Why don't we just spend $19, buy a Lightning cable, rip out the end out of it and glue it into this chassis, so at least we can put this under glass and say, hey, look, here's something that we're hoping to be producing sometime in 23, the first Lightning compatible MIDI keyboard. So I'm surprised we're not seeing more reports of these things being shown out in the open.
Yeah,
although
too.
It's possible that Apple could then say later, when they go in for their, you know, to sign the papers, Apple say, oh, look, we have this photo of you in the glass case of the MIDI keyboard. No, you can't.
Yeah.
Why? Because we said so. It's ours. You just can't. And so I know that in the past, when we've talked about 30-pin connectors, some third-party developers have been very shy about talking about it. And largely it was because of Apple's reaction. They don't want to talk about things that Apple may not approve.
But even do you think that even putting a line on their signage saying that we believe of course in Lightning, our aim is to make all of our accessories Lightning compatible by the end of the year. I'm just surprised we're not seeing at least. I know so many of these companies, and when they know that there's a risk to saying something, they will find a way to say it in such a way that they get their message out without suffering any damage. I'm not downing you. The amount of I think that a lot of the fear of Apple, there's some of it is very, very real, and some of it is very, very imagined. And even the imagined fear creates a power situation from Apple.
Yeah, in the past, at least when I was talking to people about the iPod stuff, when you would talk to people, they'd sort of pull you off to the side and say, "Well, off the record, this is what we're doing," but they don't want to. I mean, there's some that went right ahead and did it, but then it turned out that it didn't materialize. And in the case of the 30-pin connector, Apple would let some people use parts of the connector, but not other parts. And they had a way of parsing out the capabilities of this thing. And I don't know if that's an issue with Lightning or not. So sort of they will talk to you about it. They will speak to you about it when you're not recording them. But I think they don't want to put up signage that says, "We are going to do this," because I do think there's some concern about either promising and not delivering, or that Apple would say, "We haven't approved that yet."
What do you all think about the Camera Mater? This was announced at CES. If you're not familiar with it, I think this is pretty cool. It gives an SLR the functionality of iOS because you can control it from your iPhone or your iPad or your Android device, actually. And this is from a company called Hyper, and they've been around for a while. But the latest product is the Camera Mater, and supposedly it's a very small device. It's about the size of a deck of cards, a small deck of cards. You connect it to your camera's micro USB port, then everything from the viewfinder is wirelessly replicated to an app that's running on, let's say, your little iPhone. And then the Camera Mater can plug into the hot shoe, but it can also be somewhere else if you've got a flash that you want to plug in. I think this is great because it's possible. I can't quite imagine. It's almost like, my iPhone can replace my remote at home. Well, I'm not really doing that very regularly, using my iPhone as my home remote. But it's really neat that could be the case, to replicate what's going on my SLR screen. Am I the only one who thinks this is cool? Is anyone going to use this?
$300, so that kind of defines who's being targeted for. Also, I wish that there were some sort of a universal sort of accessory for that would work with most. A universal standard that makers of all kinds of cameras could put in. Right now, it supports only Canon and Nikon, and probably not the entire spectrum of them. But yeah, I mean, anything that you can do to like make your expense of this of your phone pay off in other ways, that's a really, really big deal. And so I think, but people want something that's a little bit better than a MiFi, better than an iFi card, but something less than a $3,000 camera that's specifically designed to be a remote wireless camera. And that's a pretty interesting thing.
Ken, do you think that this is pricing most consumers out of the market? $300?
I'm having a hard time. I'm so not a camera guy. I mean, I use the camera on my phone, even though I have a better point and shoot, but I mean, that's all I've got. So I'm having a hard time. I'm having a hard time following what it is or why I want it. Forgive me. I'm not. So for me, $300, no, because I don't know what it does or why I want it.
Chris, I know you were jumping in there a second ago.
Maybe I'm not reading this thing right, but it sounds like I'm simply wirelessly tethering my camera to my iOS device, which other things have been doing for the last couple of years. So what's new here?
Well, so folks in the chat room are agreeing with you. It's you obviously can remote control your camera by seeing whatever it's seeing, even if you're not holding it, even if you're a bit away from it. There's a rechargeable battery at 8 hours of battery life. You got 4 gigs of memory, so you can queue up over 500 continuous shots. The Camera Mater connects to Nikon and Canon cameras, wireless, happening this is just normal 802.11n, and Bluetooth capabilities as well. But yeah, I don't know. Well, you know, maybe it's just me. I like photo stuff just for sort of for the sake of it. So I think it.
I do think, I mean, and when you look at it, I don't know if this is a finished product they're showing, but it doesn't look like something that's designed to appeal to like regular consumers. It really looks like something more that's designed for event photographers. And I don't even try to pretend that I know anything about photography. I enjoy it and I do it a lot. But then I meet someone who's a professional photographer and I see how they prepare to shoot an event. And it really is like the invasion of Normandy only with NICADs. It's so complicated, and they're always looking for the right gadget so they can be they can have a shooter in the field at a wedding. Meanwhile, there is somebody in a room in the back of the event hall that's simply collecting all of these images and then doing something with them immediately. It's probably a good thing to get coverage at a show like CES, because everybody who is going to be seeing this with a press badge is going to be thinking, "Oh, dude, if I had one of those in my pocket right now, then I could just like auto post directly from this camera." Be filtering it all the way to my editor directly, that he could be clicking a button. Oh, dude, only $299. Sell me one right now. But yeah, I mean, for most people, if they want that sort of a thing, an iFi card will do just fine. If they want remote control, as Chris said, there are all kinds of third-party solutions that do that just fine. They're really cool, just simple, like Arduino-based projects that do remote shutter and time lapse about as well as anybody would want it to do. So, I mean, if there's a niche out there, a CES product is going to find it.
All right. Who wants to talk about anything else from CES before we move on? Because I don't want to gloss over some great story that you were hoping that I was going to bring up before we start moving into Apple buying Waze or not buying Waze. So speak now or forever say goodbye to CES. All right, we're moving on. Last week, there was a big story that went this way, and then it swung back wildly, and now we're somewhere in the middle. Did Apple offer to buy the social traffic service Waze or not? Really depends on who you're reading. The story, of course, is that the two were in talks, and of course, Apple Maps, we're all very aware of the bit of catastrophe that went down when Apple Maps replaced Google Maps, and it was lackluster, and Tim Cook apologized, and it was a real cluster F, to put it mildly. Waze was really the only app that saw significant growth. I think they had about 7% of the market on iOS, and rose up to about 10% once Apple Maps was introduced. So enjoyed a nice user growth bump. And then it sort of turned into, well, I mean, should the two team up? We've had rumors of Apple also in talks to buy Foursquare, to acquire Foursquare. Again, there's that local user data that Foursquare has been collecting for years. We still don't know where that stands. But the rumors are they talked. Maybe Waze wanted more money than Apple was offering. The number thrown around is $500 million for Waze. Waze may have wanted more. Does this partnership make sense? My first reaction was, I don't know, Waze doesn't really seem like an Apple product to me. But then again, Apple has bought products in the past and sunset them, never to be seen again. Who wants to start?
I guess the question is that would that be a good thing for Waze and its users? They're collecting so much data, not just in the United States, but worldwide. They're becoming just a monster of this sort of data set. And why would they sell themselves to another company unless there's anybody wishing to cash out? I mean, Waze is really a whole widget solution as the company stands right now, where they're supporting every platform that matters. I'm not sure what they would get by being absorbed by Apple, except for the money that Apple's going to pay them. Apple gets a big win in that they need that sort of data, but would Apple then ruin this company by saying, yeah, we'll get to Android support later on, but really we're here supporting iOS devices primarily, and then we'll support the rest of you guys later on. So it doesn't make any sense for me from Waze's point of view, but I'm not a business reporter.
Can I also ask, I mean, has sort of the initial embarrassment of the Apple Maps thing worn off at this point? I'm not saying that Apple Maps is all better, but now we've got the native Google Maps app for iOS. I mean, there are certainly other alternatives available out there. does Apple need to do like a quick fix, like by Waze and quickly integrate that stuff? Or can Apple now take the time to grow Apple Maps? Because the embarrassing time was September and October. And now it's better. I mean, you when somebody writes stories about Apple Maps at this point, unless they're writing about tech disasters of 2012, they write about how it's actually getting better. And in the meantime, there are a ton of other options out there. I mean, is it something that Apple still needs to do, or can I go ahead and grow the service at this point?
I mean, it seems...
I agree.
Go ahead, Chris.
Oh, I was going to say, I agree with Ken. I think this sounds to me like a pants on fire decision, and Apple doesn't make those kinds of decisions. That when they have a tough situation like this, whether it's the antenna or it's maps or something, they tend to weather it. And they come out and say, if it's that bad, they'll say, yes, we made a mistake. This is not good. It's going to get better. And it does get better. I think that maps is getting better. As Ken says, I think the embarrassing time was a couple of months ago. So, yes, they may have talked to Waze. I mean, it could have been somebody farther down the food chain who just said, yeah, okay, I'll go out and talk to various people and see what's out there and what's going on. But I can't see somebody at Tim Cook's level saying, we have to scrap everything we've done so far and buy them, and that's going to fix the problem. Because obviously, it's not going to fix the problem right away, because they're going to have to integrate it and get all their technology as part of this. Maybe it's iOS 7 or iOS 8. When I read the story, I just thought, this doesn't sound like the Apple I know. So yeah. I don't think so.
You know, I think part of it that gets me, too, is that Waze is very, it's social. This is all sort of built on people collaborating together and sharing information, and it works very well. Waze users always point out how well it works as a crowdsourcing model of information. Historically, Apple hasn't been good at social, hasn't really tried all that hard. And with products like Ping, you have a lot of snickering that, you know, Apple doesn't understand social. But does that mean that Apple doesn't want to understand social? It would seem to me that there have to be a lot of internal discussions at Apple trying to figure out how they do get into the social space in a smart way. And like Andy said, Waze really is on the rise internationally. I mean, Apple is very, very interested in international markets, not just the U.S. And Waze is, well, they haven't made a lot of money, but they have rolled out ad models. They've got Waze ads now that will kind of geolocate ads to you, depending on where you are and where you might want to pull off the road, I guess. Is social still an option for Apple?
Forgive me, I'm not familiar enough with Waze. I mean, is it actually a social site, or is it a mapping site that uses cues from users?
Well, it's a...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
It's a social service that will... So, for example, I'm in Petaluma right now, and I got to drive back down to San Francisco this afternoon. And through my Waze app on my iPhone, other users could be alerting me to traffic issues, an accident, maybe a police stop, something that's going on. Maybe traffic is heavy or all sorts of... situations, there's a diversion or some sort of a thing, so that in real time, I'm getting information from other users to make me help me make more informed traffic decisions.
Yeah. So when people say, forgive me really quickly, so when people say that Apple's bad at social, though, I mean, that's not the kind of social that Apple's bad at, is it? I mean, they're bad at maps right now, but it doesn't seem like adding people like, you know, you and me to that. I mean, that might be helpful if they could integrate it perfectly and quickly. But I mean, the problem with Ping wasn't that Apple didn't understand music. It was that they didn't understand, you know, how people wanted to use a social service. So Waze doesn't really solve their social problem. It might solve their mapping problem, but that's probably going to be solved over time anyway.
Also, I use Waze all the time. I love it. I don't consider it a social service. It's social, I think, in the sense that it's real. It collects information simply by virtue of the fact that you've got the Waze app running on your phone and you're driving. But the real meat of it is that you get real humans able to say, there's a car pulled over at exit 13 and 995 in the northbound lane, and you get that information immediately. And also the ability to if a road's been if you're using map data to get to somewhere and you find yourself on a road that's closed down for construction for a month, you then have the ability to simply push a button on the phone saying there's a problem right here in the map. And then later on, you or somebody else who's taken upon themselves to be the sheriff of the map for their community can say, oh, yeah, that's right. That's going to be shut down for 3 months. They can then go in and edit that map that day. And after a very blazingly short approvals process, then the Waze will stop trying to send people over across that closed road. But really, the reason why Ping failed is that social is not all about the users of the one same product all getting together and forming a community. It's about being able to let that information leak out to everybody using every service, which is why you want to share your music data through Facebook or through Twitter or through pretty much anything else but the closed ecosystem of people who are using iTunes. So if Waze were to become that kind of a thing, I don't think that it's fun to me when I can report when traffic is at a standstill. I love the fact that I can push a button on my phone and amuse myself while I'm not moving forward and say traffic is down to zero, no movement of any cars whatsoever, and hope that someone else who's using this app will benefit from the information. If I know that it's a smaller community of just iPhone users and it's not going to be available to everybody on every device who wants to do anything, that might be, well, why am I helping Apple make their proprietary product, their iPhone, more valuable? I mean, may as well just listen to a radio instead.
Well, in any case, doesn't look like Apple's buying Waze, but they're probably the two companies that probably were in talks. You know, this is, it seems like that would be not too far-fetched of an idea, particularly because, hey, you know, Apple's paying attention to the competition and other mapping services that are better competitors to Google Maps than maybe Apple's own Maps technology is overall. Okay, should we talk about Tim Cook going to China? Because he made a second visit to China in less than a year. In fact, in less than 10 months. This is coinciding with Apple stores continuing to open in China since March, when Tim Cook made his first visit. He pledged more investment in China, computers, mobile phones. Since then, Apple has doubled the number of its stores in China and Hong Kong to 11. It was six stores back during Cook's first visit. The first store opened in Beijing in 2008. Beijing now has three stores. Shanghai and Hong Kong also have three, one in Chengdu, one in Shenzhen. So yeah, there's a lot of talk like, what is Tim Cook doing in China again? You know, he keeps going over there. That's a big deal. China's also a huge market. Apple's really gunning for that market. Think there's anything going on than what looks like on the surface, just keeping up appearances and keeping the folks happy in China?
They've been pushing China a lot in the last year, and I think they recognize that the tiger has awoken. This is no longer the sleeping tiger, and that there's a serious market there. There are a lot of people in China. They now are starting to have money in order to buy Apple devices. Apple has made improvements in iOS to address the Chinese market. They're dealing with the telecoms there, saying, what can we do to become your primary phone? Those deals are starting to work out as well. So it's just about piles of money, whether it's Chinese money or American dollars or it's gold. Tim Cook is a smart guy. He understands this is one of the big markets. I expect, although probably not getting the same kind of press, that Apple is also in Brazil, and they're probably doing a lot of work there as well, because that's another emerging market. So, I'm not surprised. What surprised me actually was seeing Schmidt go to North Korea. I thought that was a much more interesting visit than Cook doing what probably he should have done and go to China.
Although he was accompanying Bill Richardson, who said, this is not a Google thing. This is a humanitarian effort on our part. So don't read into it like this has anything to do with Eric Schmidt representing Google. I mean, I think Tim Cook is very clearly representing Apple, or he wouldn't be in China.
Right. Yeah, if you're Eric Schmidt, you're Eric Schmidt. And so if you go somewhere and people are there with cameras and they're taking pictures of you, it says something.
Sure.
if he really wanted to do this on the sly, he probably could have done that. But clearly this was a press event of some kind. And so he could try to divorce himself from Google. But the fact is, he's Eric Schmidt. It's like if you're Bono and you go somewhere and people are there with cameras, there's something going on. There's some kind of agenda here. It's just, you know, you're not just having a vacation in beautiful, sunny, balmy North Korea.
The surprising part to me of that article was to hear that Steve Jobs had never actually been to China. But, I mean, it does speak to how much bigger China has gotten for Apple. I mean, just even in the past, you know, year and a half that we haven't had Steve Jobs as CEO. Well, I guess 2 years now since he went on his last medical leave about 2 years ago. But China has just gotten so much bigger for Apple even since then. So, I mean, it's hard to say that it's something special going on, except that, I mean, China's, I mean, listen to Tim Cook on every conference call, every earnings call. China's a very special place to Tim Cook and to Apple. And has a huge place in his heart. So, yeah, it seems like just business has gotten so much bigger there in the past couple of years that he'll probably be there at least once a year, I would think, if not more.
Sure, and he was the supply chain guy, even when Jobs was at the helm. So this is probably the market that Tim Cook was the expert at anyway. And now he's the face of the company, and you're probably right. He probably will be there on a regular basis, quite often, in fact. All right, should we take a little break? Everybody have a drink of water while I talk about a great little service called Gazelle. I just moved recently, and I've got this drawer of old iDevices. It's like embarrassing because part of me feels nostalgic and I don't want to get rid of them, but I'm not using them because, come on, I can only use one iPhone at once. This is why Gazelle is the jam, because it's the fast and simple way to sell your iPhone, your iPad, your MacBook, even your Android smartphone. You can find out what your gadget is worth, and then you can get cash to upgrade to the latest iPhone. Let's talk about the iPhone for a second. Let's say you don't have the iPhone 5 yet and you really, really want it. Or are you like me? Do you have some old stuff that you might be able to get some cash for? Before you get the new iPhone, make sure you sell your used phone to Gazelle for cash. Here's how you do it. You go to gazelle.com, G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com, just like the animal. And then you tell Gazelle the condition of your phone. And be honest, because, you know, if the condition changes when they get it, they'll have to fudge the price. But they'll buy a broken iPhone. I mean, if your iPhone is in bad shape, don't think that you'll get $0 for it. It's still going to be worth it. Then what you do, based on what you've told them, is they'll give you a risk-free offer for your gadget. Locks you in for 30 days. So once you have that offer, you know in the next 30 days, that's what you're going to get if your iPhone is indeed in that condition. Once you get your new iPhone, you ship your old one to Gazelle. They'll even pay for shipping. They'll go ahead and pick that up for you. And then you get paid quickly by check or by PayPal if you prefer to go the checkless, the paperless route. Go to gazelle.com now to get an offer for your phone. And you want to do it today because, obviously, as we know, these things tend to depreciate in value. So waiting doesn't really help you that much. You should do it as soon as possible. Again, offers are good for 30 days. So you have time to get your new iPhone before you need to send in your current iPhone. So you don't have this situation where you don't have a phone at all while you've sent your old iPhone to Gazelle and then you're waiting. Gazelle has paid out almost $50 million to over 300,000 customers. A lot of happy people using Gazelle. So if you're like me and you've got to get rid of some of those old iPhones, now is the time. There's no reason to be sitting on that money. Think about it. iPhone 4, you got one of those? It's possible. iPhone 3GS, 4S. What is your iPhone worth? Just take a minute, go to gazelle.com and find out, and then sell your used iPhone today. Gazelle.com. And thanks to Gazelle for sponsoring this episode of Mac Break Weekly. Well, should we talk about iPhone rumors? I almost hate to do it because I know people out there are like, oh, no, please, come on. It's only the first couple weeks of 2013. What does everyone make of the idea that Apple could sell a lower cost iPhone with a new design, completely new design, larger display, lower cost? Does any of this make any sense?
I don't know. I mean, a larger display makes sense. I mean, I've said before
Doesn't?
That. Because that's where the trends are going. I mean, you put in there aren't any other manufacturers that are exclusively tying down to these narrow, tinier phones. The standard is now going for a slightly larger display. It's not crazy stupid big like the Note 2, but at least larger enough that text is bigger and easier to read, targets are easier to hit. I'm wondering how much longer they're going to go with the standard, with the form factor they have with the iPhone 5. Cheaper, I don't know how it's the difference between seeing how the phones are sold in the United States, where you can get them for free, you can get them for $49, you can get them for $99, or you can pay full boat, versus how they go internationally, where Apple is losing is internationally, where there isn't quite so much uniformity of pricing. It's time and time again in different markets where consumers have the opportunity to either spend more money for an iPhone, which is the better phone, which is the better name, which is the most prestigious name, or less money for an Android phone. They're spending less money for an Android phone. So, but the bottom line is that Apple's, I'm not sure if they would actually do that. I mean, what I'm saying is it makes sense, but I'm not sure if that's what Apple would do, because they're doing just fine with their game plan as it goes right now. And they know that the way that they continue to succeed is to always be producing a premium product, not just an actually premium product, but something that's perceived to be a premium product. So I think the moment that they put the Apple logo on something that isn't in the same class as an iPhone 5 is the time when they feel as though they're suddenly going off of the wonderfully illuminated, even paved road that they've been driving to victory for the past 5 to 10 years, and going a little bit more off-road into uncertainty.
I should mention that this is a rumor that comes from Digitimes. So grains of salt, whenever it comes from Digitime. But what's weird about this is that it's okay, let's just take the grain of salt and say, all right, well, cheaper device. One analyst calls it the iPhone Mini. if it was to make a debut later this year, aimed at maybe a market like China, how does the cheaper iPhone and bigger iPhone make any sense? I mean, bigger usually means you got to pay for more material, right?
There was Chris, go ahead. No, please,
go ahead, please.
Well,
okay. Because you said it twice.
Okay. You go first and then I'll
No, tell. please. So I said it three times.
Okay. Ago. I went, wow, nice. I'm not going to run up you. There was an interesting article last week, I think it was in the Telegraph out of the UK, that said Samsung's moves in smartphones may force Apple to come out with an iPhone Mini. And that was all built around a quote from Neil Mostyn from Strategy Analytics, but he never actually said that. What he said was that Samsung was going to gain more market share from Apple. And then parenthetically, unless, of course, Apple comes out with an iPhone Mini. He didn't talk about what the iPhone Mini was at that point. Now, this week, there was an interesting story, I believe in Business Insider, although it might have been a Reuters piece, that said that 2013 is going to be the year of the phablet, which is that sort of that Samsung Note 2 thing. So you've got something that's sort of between a big smartphone and a small tablet. And the person who said that 2013 is going to be the year of the phablet is Neil Mostyn from Strategy Analytics. Now, at least when he says that about the phablet, we have some idea of what they're talking about. The thing that I don't get is, I mean, what you're saying, how does Apple guard its profit margin, which there was another analyst who I missed their story yesterday, but it'll probably be on tomorrow's macOS can, saying that what Apple really has to do is lower its profit margin so it can get more market share. But as Andy said, why? I mean, they're doing fantastic, you know, selling their $629 phone. And no, not everybody has one. And yet Apple still manages to be the most valuable company on the planet. And they manage to make more profit in cell phones than anybody else. The one question I have about the phablet and the iPad mini is, couldn't you turn an iPad, I'm sorry, phablet and iPhone mini, couldn't you turn an iPad into that without cheapening what you're doing with the iPhone? If you sell an iPad mini with a cellular connection, then you've got all sorts of voice over IP options and you don't have to cannibalize the iPhone, right?
What do you think, Chris?
No, I agree. The problem with the difference between a phone and something like an iPad or an iPod Touch is the data plan. That's where the money is. So if people are talking about making a smaller phone or a cheaper phone, right now Apple sells an iPhone 4S for $99. That's pretty cheap. And if you want to go with an iPhone 4, it's free, except you're paying for 2 years of your contract. So it, this kind of money that you're spending is all going into your plan. So you really can't suck the low end of the market out, because you're already selling a cheap phone. So it isn't really about the price of the hardware quite so much. Now, if Apple could do something where it did have something like the phablet or the iPad mini or something, and really pushed hard on voice over IP and got people to move in that direction and cut out the middlemen, that could become much more interesting.
The only problem with doing that is then you upset AT&T, Sprint, Verizon, O2,
right?
Name everybody else around the world. I mean, yeah. More to Andy's point, I mean, you're right about the free iPhone 4 and the iPhone 4S here, but that's here. I mean, and that's in, you know, Western markets. If you're talking about them wanting to take over China, the subsidized phone market isn't happening quite as much there, right? I mean, that's one of the big pushes for the iPad mini right now. I can't remember who the analyst was that said it yesterday, or I mentioned it again on today's Mac OS Ken, but basically the idea is Apple is leaving piles of money on the table in China. And it's weird to think about China's population. There are so many people in China that even though most people there can't afford an iPhone, there are enough people there that can afford it. There's still going to be this gangbuster, you know, market, even selling the high-priced iPhone. But if the idea behind the iPad or the iPhone mini is that you're going to be able to get everybody, then you can't talk about the iPhone 4 because that doesn't work. I mean, the phone itself works in China, right. But they're not giving away the iPhone 4 for free in China because they're not giving away anything for free in China, are they?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think I do think that's coming. I think subsidized is probably the way the carriers would prefer to go, because they're certainly getting their pound of flesh there rather than you buying a phone outright. So, I think that the Western model is probably going to migrate there rather than the Eastern model migrating here.
That's an interesting idea.
Well, we are talking about rumors, but maybe we should talk about actual concrete numbers. Truth. This came from Apple. Apple itself, the Apple's App Store, has reached 40 billion downloads. And what's interesting about that 40 billion number is almost half of that occurred just last year in 2012. So 2012 was quite a year for app downloads. There are more than 500 million active accounts in the App Store. More than 775,000 applications for the iPhone, iPad, and iPod Touch. Developers have enjoyed, well, some developers more than others, of course, have been paid out more than $7 billion to date collectively. Eddie Q, SVP of Internet Software and Services, says, developers have made over $7 billion on the App Store, and we continue to invest in providing them with the best ecosystem so that they can create the most innovative apps in the world. So this is kind of good news. This is something that Apple rolled out right before CES. Sort of like, hey, man, we've got some good stuff to talk about here. We don't really care about CES. Look at us.
Hey, look at us. We didn't spend any money to have a booth, and you're still writing about us.
That's right. They also used this announcement to highlight some of the apps that are successful, that people have enjoyed of the many, many hundreds of thousands of apps that they can download. Not all are very helpful or good. Temple Run was downloaded 75 million times. Uber, they didn't add numbers for Uber, but that's the sort of taxi alternative, something that I use all the time. That's actually a really great app. They redesigned it recently. Flipboard, of course, everybody's favorite. It's Leo and I can't get through an episode of iPad a day without talking about how much we like Flipboard. We really don't want to talk about it anymore, but it just is good. Hotel Tonight, Airbnb. Apple says of those 775,000 applications in the App Store, more than 300,000 are iPad native. So that's good news, of course, for iPad owners who don't just like to 2X just those little iPhone apps. And the App Store is available in 155 countries. So, you know, we were talking about the international market earlier in the show. This is definitely good news as far as the App Store's reach. And options on the store fall under 23 different categories. So, you know, news and tech and food and all that good stuff. the numbers are very, very impressive. I tend to, I think, especially since I review iOS apps for a living, the longer it goes on and the more apps that are available, the more I realize, you know, I can only really use 10 apps that regularly at a time. What are some of your favorite apps? Have I mentioned any of them?
Definitely Flipboard. Definitely Evernote, which I suddenly became a convert to just about a month or two ago. It's great to hear about how many hundreds of thousands of apps there are and how many billions of dollars there are. I think everybody, though, has those top 10 apps that they turn to each and every day, of which probably four or five are almost common to everybody who uses an iPad. It's interesting, though. My eye was caught by the number about how they essentially doubled their throughput in 1 year. That tracks with Comixology, the company that sells digital comic books. They sold 50 million comics through, I think, like the first quarter of 2012, and then two quarters later had sold their 100 millionth comic. So there's something going on where just there's a lot more velocity in mobile, and it's all happening in 2012.
Ken, do you think that's just more people having access to iOS devices, that the number sort of seems exponentially growing?
I would imagine, yeah. And that and getting more comfortable with it. I mean, but yes, I would think that would largely be it. I mean, my mom, I know, didn't have an anything until 2011. She got her first iPhone last year, and now she's got an iPad as well. So, I mean, yeah, as more people pile on, you're just automatically going to have more app downloads. The thing that I found, the real point of that whole thing, I wondered, and it was based on something that I read somewhere, I want to say maybe it was in Fortune, but I can't remember for certain, was the 500 million active account. I wonder if the whole press release was kind of for that, because there was a couple of stories towards the end of the year that Microsoft was starting to try to woo away iOS developers, or at least get their attention as well, and that Google was also trying to get the attention of iOS developers as well. And so you're right. On the one hand, you've got people talking about this, you know, the week of CES, but then you've also got, you know, Apple sort of, I mean, 500 million active accounts and $7 billion are two great messages for developers. And, you know, all the stuff about J.J. Abrams and all the stuff about Temple Run, that's neat window dressing. But if I were a developer and I was trying to decide where I was going to throw my weight, that was a good message, I think, from Apple.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think this was really a lot about the timing, CES, after the beginning of a new year. These are good numbers to sort of showcase to developers and say, hey, if you were thinking of developing for Android or for Microsoft or anybody else, I think $7 billion. See if you see that kind of headline for anybody else. Not likely. So again, put your resources toward us. It's a brand new year. $7 billion last year. Let's see what we do this year.
Yeah.
So
it's a very weird thing, but because the other piece of data that I'm getting is that even though Android has made a lot of leaps forward in activity on the Google Play Store, there's just something anthropological about the Android user that he or she does not want to buy stuff. So there's a wealth beyond the actual numbers at play here, where if someone has an iPhone in their hands, they are far, far more likely, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but X number of iPhone users will spend as much money on apps as a greater number of Android users. So it's an interesting metric at play. I don't know exactly why that is. Either it's because iTunes just makes it easier to discover and purchase apps, or because people who are buying Android, they want to save money. They don't necessarily want to have the flashiest, latest phone. Whatever they have that came pre-installed and maybe one or two extras is fine by them. And the other interesting thing is that it's nice to think that this is a burgeoning and very flourishing and diverse app market, but the lion's share of money is going to games. I think something like 50% of all money transacted on iTunes is for games. So if you're a game developer, then that's where the gold rush is. If you want to make the next great news app or the next great productivity app, maybe you wouldn't necessarily be saying, I want to develop for Android first, but maybe your thinking would be, I want to be co-developing iOS and Android side by side, and I want to presence on both platforms to essentially give my app that extra little evolutionary advantage of diversity.
Do you think any of this has to do with at least the large numbers of app downloads have to do with some of the apps that help you find apps that are on sale or free for a limited time, which is something that Apple has actually not only been discouraging, but in certain cases, putting lockdown on? Those are services that I'm aware of, and I know that people enjoy. But how much widespread usage do you think that contributes to an increase in downloads in 2012 alone? Nobody.
Can I phone a friend?
I'm trying to be creative with where's these numbers coming from? I know it's more people having iPads and iPhones, but maybe there's something more going on.
Well, I think that there's also that people who use Apple stuff, and I'm sure Android users would slag me for this, but I think that people who use Apple stuff are more engaged. I've seen that in other markets. I see that in my own business, that when we talk about people who are reading about Apple stuff versus Microsoft stuff or even Android, that Apple users tend to be really engaged and put some effort into what they use their technology for. And I think that translates, at least in this case, into people downloading and paying for applications. And also, when I look at the Android market, I have a Nexus 7, and I tried to sort of replicate what I had on my iPad mini on a Nexus 7, and I just couldn't. I can't find a decent Twitter client on Android. I've tried a bunch of different ones. I haven't found a good ebook reader on Android. I have to think that stuff's out there, that the developer's interested in it, but maybe those who are capable of making really amazing utilities like this look at Android and just say, there's not enough money there. I'm going to go where the money is and develop for iOS instead.
So we're starting to see a turnaround. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, forgive me. What year was it that Apple opened the iTunes Music Store? Was it 2004 or 2005?
It was 2004.
2005.
Okay.
2004 and a half. We're just going to cut the baby right down the
So since 2004 and a half, Apple has had our payment information, right? And we're sort of used to buying from iTunes. So, I mean, that could be part of it as well. There's no real hurdle to jump there. I mean, you have to know that, okay, well, I'm not buying music anymore. I'm buying an application. But we had years of buying stuff from Apple before we started with the whole app thing. So, I mean, that could be part of it too. There's a trust that's already built there between Apple and the iOS users and the people who are buying apps. And, you know, you might trust Google to find something for you online, but you haven't been spending money with them since 2004 and a half. As you have with Apple.
I'm sorry, we're both wrong. It was 2003.
It was? Oh, man.
Really?
I was remembering, because I remember talking about it back on Tech TV, and could have sworn that was 2004, but oh, well. All right, we were both wrong, but I was closer without going over if we were on the prices right.
We both overbid, so.
Darn it. Yes. You know the rules better than me.
The person who guessed 1AD gets to talk to Drew Carey and win the car.
Darn it. Hey, Consumer Reports says the iPhone 5 is horrible. Well, not horrible. It's the worst of the top smartphones. Consumer Reports has been good to the iPhone and has been hard on the iPhone, depending on the issue. Famously, they were not too fond of AntennaGate. Consumer Reports says of the top smartphones, and so this is not on all phones, of course, this is just a certain list, that they don't spell out exactly the reasonings for it being the worst, but they are going to, it's going to appear in the February issue of the magazine. And they break it out into, on AT&T and Sprint, the iPhone 5 is behind the LG Optimus G, the Android phone, and also the Samsung Galaxy S3. This Galaxy S3, I know, is extremely popular phone. I'm not as familiar with the LG Optimus G, and I don't know if any of you guys are. On Verizon, the iPhone 5 is underneath the Motorola Droid Razr Max, the Motorola Droid Razr HD, and again, that Samsung Galaxy S3. Consumer Reports, sometimes people say, yeah, who even listens to Consumer Reports anymore? But a lot of people do. I know plenty of people, some in the older category, but certainly people who just respect the brand, who buy the magazine, who really pay attention to this stuff. First of all, who's using the LG Optimus G who can tell me if it's better than the iPhone 5 or not? Because I've never used it. Anyone?
I had one for exactly 2 weeks, during which time it didn't really impress me very much. But that's just, there's just nothing in it that's got me to really start playing with it. It's a very good, like, high-level Android smartphone. They just did an update to it. Matter of fact, just the other day, according to something that I think I remember getting some information about 2 days ago. But when you look at this table, I mean, here's how much the iPhone 5 is the worst. They got a score of 77. The Galaxy S3 got a score of 78, and the Optimus G a score of 79. Mm-hmm. So not exactly a blowout. I think that the Consumer Reports reviews in the past, they've been useful if you put them within, you know, the constellation of reviews from various sources. They tend to be very Spock-like in how they review products, in which they will say, well, this one has near-field communication. Does this one have near-field? Ooh, this one doesn't have near-field communication. Let's put an X mark on this box and a check mark on this box. And they're not really good at that sort of analog sort of thing, where if you're using which at the end of 1 month of using the Galaxy S3 and the iPhone 5 and the Optimus G, basically measure all the dents that you have put into the wall opposite your office in Fury and see which ones were created by the iPhone, which ones were created by the Android phones. Things like that, they just don't enter into their stuff. I do agree with some of the basics of what's being reported about the review, in that I do think that you don't necessarily buy an Apple phone because you're going to get the best device, the latest hardware, and the most attractive features. I think that it is a whole package sort of thing, as opposed to an individual component sort of thing. So I can see where someone could come to that conclusion, but again, they tend to be very, very Spock-like when they review products.
Chris, what do you make of Consumer Reports saying iPhone 5, it's not the top, it's not even in second place?
I have three things to say about this. Business Insider, Henry Blodgett, Consumer Reports. The triple death threat. Yeah, you know, people who know understand exactly what I'm talking about. And those who don't, never mind.
Apple and Samsung are the only two smartphone makers seeing growth in the U.S. Well, that's got to be depressing. You know, I asked about that wonderful LG phone. The only two smartphone manufacturers that are seeing growth, again, this is U.S. only, are Apple and Samsung. So that means LG, Motorola, RIM, HTC, that market share continues to fall. You know, it's funny, on Tech News Today, over the holidays, we sort of do this fun little prediction show where we try to predict what are going to be the big news stories in 2013 and sort of beyond, but mostly over the next year. And they're, I mean, they're supposed to be serious, but you know, you can sometimes get a little far-fetched. And one of my predictions was Samsung's going to buy HTC and they're going to become an Android super company. And everyone sort of laughed at me. And it's like, I don't know. I don't know if it's that crazy, because Samsung is getting into a position where it's really so far ahead of the pack. And I'm kind of talking about Android, but I'm talking really about handsets in general. You know, anything that's not iOS. Is this surprising to anybody else, or is an Apple and Samsung game, at least in the U.S. market, going forward?
Not the Apple part. Samsung sort of, it surprised me that Samsung was the only other one showing growth, and I kind of wonder. I haven't spent enough time with Samsung phones, so I'm not bashing them. I wonder how much of it, though. I mean, especially if you want to give credence to the Consumer Reports reviews that you were talking about, then obviously Samsung's not the only other one that's making good alternatives to the iPhone. So it was kind of surprising to see that. Part of me wonders how much of it is the marketing of the Samsung stuff, and how much of it is, I mean, the stories for the past, what, close to a year, I mean, or between the legal fights between Samsung and Apple, and then just the marketing fights between Samsung and Apple, and then the stories that Samsung is growing, I mean, is not going to, you know, hurt Samsung in any way. It was weird to see that nobody else was growing, but.
Sure. And these are for anybody who's like, well, what is the period are we talking about? The 3 months leading up to November 2012. So Samsung's market share increased from 25.7 to 26.9%. Apple's share increased from 17.1 to 18.5%. And then we've got not huge, huge fall offs, but LG dropped up 0.7%. Motorola dropped 0.8%. HTC dropped 0.4%. So, you know, Samsung's market share is the healthiest, I suppose. But it does sort of surprise me. Well, you know, RIM, the RIM thing doesn't surprise me because they're in a bit of a holding period right now. Windows Phone, Symbian, it's a lot of that. The smaller operating systems, a lot of this has to do with just the adoption of Android, of course, and that Samsung, yeah, I mean, not only do they make good phones, but I think all of us can think of at least a couple of Samsung commercials that we've seen in the last few months that were really effective. You know, whether you liked them or not, you remember them. You know, they made you feel something, and that counts for a lot.
Right. Well, they've set themselves up as the not Apple at this point. I mean, particularly their advertising, when they had, you know, people lining up for the iPhone 5 and they have the commercial of the guy out there and it turns out the iPhone is for your parents, but you're really cool. You slap your phone together with your best friend who's there and something happens that's magical. So good on them for their advertising. They've done very well. And I think they really have set them up that way. I think what's interesting about the story is that it's a market share versus money issue. And I think that's always going to be the case with Apple, that yes, another manufacturer, could be Samsung, is going to have a greater market share. And so for their PR department, they get bragging rights for that. But Apple's going to say, yeah, but look, we're making a lot more money on what we're selling than you are. So we win, right? However, if Apple were to get both more money and greater market share, you know that PR would be out there saying, we've got the greatest market share in the world and we're making more money than anybody else. So yeah, I think, you know, mostly pundits would say market share, schmarket share, it's how much money you have in the bank. And so far, Apple is certainly on top of that.
Yeah. But it's a little bit chilling. Maybe that's too strong a word, though. When I think this is the first year that I've seen any phone that was advertised and marketed as aggressively and as successfully as an iPhone was. The first time that I got off a commuter train at Boston South Station, which is the main commuter terminal, and saw every single kiosk ad was a Galaxy S3 ad. When you enter the terminal, from a panoramic from side to side is one big Samsung Galaxy S3 ad. You walk into the main atrium, every single hanging ad is a Galaxy S3 ad. And is it any surprise? And for the first time, there's an Android commercial that we can all remember and quote. Outside of that, really annoying, you know, droid, you know, commercial from Motorola. So this is the first time we've had a phone that's been marketed as well as the iPhone, and coincidentally, this is the first one that Android phone that really has that kind of a penetration in people's heads. This was another first for me was when I had the S3 for testing. And was waiting in as a Chipotle, ordered my burrito. They're assembling the burrito. And then the person assembling the burrito says, hey, is that the new Galaxy S3? Yes. Is it as awesome as they say it is? Yeah. Oh, my God. It's like my dream phone. And I had to look and say, this is the S3. And you're not like a wolf who's juggling, which would indicate this is a dream I'm having as opposed to reality. So it's a little bit chilling to think that, well, what if Apple did not market the iPhone as successfully as they did? What if they didn't have the bus ads everywhere? What if they didn't have those really cool commercials for them? Would it be as successful as it is today based solely on what it is and the features that it was able to provide, particularly for the first couple of years? So, I mean, it's no wonder that Samsung's doing so well. They're doing great products, and also they're letting people know that they're doing great products.
Yeah, aren't they like the first Android phone or the first producer of Android phones to have one that doesn't do that annoying droid voice that you're talking about, you know, that pretends to drop Beyonce into your phone? Or for some reason there was lightning. There was lightning in every single Android phone ad for a very long time. And then there was one, my favorite one, actually, forgive me. My favorite one was this guy who, like, you know, picked up a phone and then he was suddenly enveloped in a bubble. And it seemed like the bubble was going to be a spaceship that was going to take him someplace. But it turns out it didn't really take him anywhere. Like, literally, like, even in the commercial, he didn't go anywhere in the bubble. He was just sitting in the bubble playing with his phone and being surrounded by all this stuff, but not moving or doing anything. I mean, the cool thing about Apple's ads at the time that everybody was, you know, throwing lightning at the phone was it just showed you how it worked. Samsung has taken a different approach and made fun of people who care about the iPhone, but... like you said, it's very memorable. They're funny. If they didn't, you know, insult me personally, they're great ads. So, I mean, the question is there enough in Motorola's tank or HTC's tank or, you know, LG's tank to do the same kind of thing? Because people don't, you know, want lightning on their phone. They want to know how the phone is going to help them. They want to know how the phone is going to, you know, work for them. But they don't want to feel stupid buying it. Right. They want, I mean, you can sort of sit at the cool kids table if you do the Samsung thing, because did you see all the cool kids on the commercial? That was fun.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. All right. Let's take a break. It's going to be a fun one, though, because I want to tell you about Pond 5. And this is actually really good for a lot of people I know who watch and listen to Mac Break Weekly, because it's for creative types, people who make blogs, websites, videos, apps, I mean, media people. This is what Pond 5 is made for. So if you build these kinds of things, you know that stock media really comes in handy. You know, you need video of lightning, for example. You're putting together maybe some sort of a video for a client, or you need some sort of a really great picture of a toucan or something very specific. Well, you might not just have that in your own arsenal, and it can be very, you know, you can't just take that off of the internet. You got to be smart about it, and you want really, really good quality. That's where Pond 5 comes in. It's a building block and creative resource for you and your projects. You can get the media that you are looking for. We're talking video, we're talking photos, music tracks, sound effects, 3D models, I mean, customizable motion graphics templates. This is really above and beyond just a few pictures here and there. Their collection is growing every day. It is pretty impressive. All of the content on Pond 5 can be downloaded legally in virtually any media production, and it has really, really affordable pricing, which is, you know, what, of course, you're waiting for. Is like, is this going to just going to break my bank? No, the whole point of Pond 5 is to help you make great projects that you can afford. Developers can use Pond 5 for high quality sound effects for games. Designers can use Pond 5. So you just don't have to build everything from scratch. Sometimes time is of the essence, right? Film and video makers, you can use HD footage from Pond 5. So you just get that perfect shot that looks really, really good. It kind of matches all that other HD footage that you have. If you're an artist, you will love Pond 5. The traditional stock agency business is, they're running for the hills, because an open, artist-friendly marketplace for professional content is what Pond 5 offers. Gives you control over pricing. If you're an artist selling on the site, you can say, all right, no, this is what I think it's worth, or this is the number I want to go for. Pond 5 really, really wants to work with artists in that realm. And they pay out 50% royalties for each and every sale. That's a higher payout than other stock photo marketplaces, and Pond 5 is really, really proud of that. So prices are good. Range and quality of the content is good. If you are a media maker or artist, you really should check out Pond 5. Take your creativity to another level, or upload your own content and see who's going to use it. Yeah, the world's most artist-friendly marketplace for stock media. This month of January, you can get 50 free stock media files at pond5.com/MacBreak. 50 free stock media files. Just go to pond5.com/MacBreak. And get yourself some of that free media. Why not try it out? See what Pond 5 has to offer. You know, we've had fun before trying to stump Pond 5. You know, you just enter, I don't know, something crazy into the search bar. They've really got a lot of media there. So thanks again to Pond 5 for sponsoring this episode of Mac Break Weekly. You guys are fun. Love Pond 5. Well, I've been avoiding the litigation section of our Mac Break Weekly rundown simply because... well, you know, patent wars. But I feel like we should probably talk about the fact that Amazon's App Store has been ruled not false advertising after all. Apple is claiming quite a few things, actually. I mean, this doesn't mean that Amazon's App Store is in the clear. Apple has, there's a whole trademark infringement thing going on. So this is just one of the counts. But the court has ruled, this is a United States District Court, has dismissed Apple's claim that Amazon's App Store, all one word, is false advertising. Apple had said App Store implies that they're affiliated with us. And we're not. We're two different things. Court said, no. Amazon, the mere use of the word App Store cannot be construed as a representation that the nature, the characteristics, or the quality of the Amazon App Store is the same of the Apple App Store, and that Amazon was not deceiving users of believing somehow that they were associated with Apple, since of course the App Store is related to Android. So this is one ruling out of six parts of Apple's case against Amazon. Maybe a step in the right direction, though. I mean, I don't know about everybody else on our panel here, but I'm certainly not confused. I understand that Amazon and Apple are two different companies and two different app stores that don't overlap. Unless the developers have made two different versions of their apps, but that's up to them.
Yeah, I'll tell you a story.
Sorry, go ahead.
So, in Australia, they have trampolines. They have a lot of trampolines. I don't know why. I don't know what it is about Australia and trampolines, but they have a lot of trampolines, and these trampolines do not have nets around them. And many of them are on concrete. And if you go to a park, you go to a motel, you go somewhere, a trailer park or somewhere to have a good time, here is this trampoline. There are no signs around the trampoline. Rather, you get on the trampoline, and the Australians, rightly, I think, understand that you will understand that this is a trampoline, this is concrete, and if you were to jump on this thing and fly off and hit the concrete, that's your problem. So what this goes to illustrate is I think that it would help if the entire American legal system were to go to Australia, jump on the trampoline a little bit, fall off, hurt themselves, find out that nobody's going to give them any money, and then come back to this country. And then when one of these cases comes along, they will say, oh, for Pete's sake, nobody's going to believe this, so get out of here. This is a trampoline. This is cement. We understand what this is and what it's not. And that is my story for today.
You know, on the other hand, though, the American legal system might go to Australia and see it as the land of milk and honey. Look at all of these lawsuits waiting to happen. Somebody True. Jump on this trampoline, please, and then fall off. And then it still solves your problem, just in a different way.
Well, I'm not sure if I agree with your analogy, Chris, because this is a trampoline in Australia, so that if you don't get bitten by a half a centimeter wide venomous spider and die instantly, they're thrilled just to be alive. If they just break exactly. their neck falling off, that's still a win as far as they're concerned. But I mean, don't you think that, like, in your first year of law school, one of the first mandatory first semester courses is here's how to keep a straight face while you try to tell a judge how your client has been wronged. Say, but Your Honor, people are going to think that iPhone apps are being sold for these non-Apple phones. It's gonna happen. Okay, C minus at best. Now we're gonna go back to one. Oh goodness gracious! It's like yeah. You got to sue, you got to sue, you got to sue, don't you?
I suppose so. Well, do we want to talk about the patent troll that's suing Apple and Google and everybody under the sun? I don't even quite understand. Okay, let's. I've said it, so I'll see if anybody can explain it better than me. So the plaintiff is a limited liability company, LLC, called Steelhead, registered in Delaware. The patent in question covers mobile radio handover initiation determination. So in other words, it's choosing which cell base station has the best signal as a handset moves around throughout the world. The defendants are Apple, Google, Motorola, RIM, HTC, Sony, LG, NEC, Casio, Pantech, Kyocera, ZTE, Sprint, AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, and MetroPCS. So the origin of the suit is U.S. patent number 5,491,834, which comes from BT, British Telecom, now known as BT, which was filed back in 1993. It was granted in 1996. It is still listed as belonging to BT, but apparently BT says, we sold all of the rights to the patents last year. We have no involvement in Steelhead Licensing LLC's litigation activity. I think that was a tweet, actually. And a BT spokesperson told GigaOM, BT doesn't share in Steelhead's licensing income. So at that point, how does Steelhead proceed? If this is a BT, former BT patent, that now BT says, we don't, this isn't us. This has nothing to do with us. The patent's origins are legit, but there, have I described this accurately? Because, you know, patent trolls are patent trolls. This seems very trolly.
Could you put this in terms of trampolines and cement slabs? Because I'm not, who's the trampoline?
I was going to ask you to tell that story again, if you would, Chris.
I don't know. I have no idea what even that means. But again, it's one of those things where you just go, look, I mean, the judge just holds up the piece of paper that says patent troll. That's you. That's you right there. So get out. Not only get out, we're going to put you in jail just because we can.
It's like another version of the lottery, right? I mean, it seems to be. And maybe that's oversimplifying. And not as colorful as the trampolines in Australia, too. But it feels like, I mean, like between and class action suits, those are the ones that actually bother me more than the patent trolls, because at least the patent trolls, you know, laid out a little capital. They bought some patents at some point that they were hoping was going to do something for them, as opposed to the ones that were like, hey, for 3 weeks, you know, this service didn't work properly, and even though it does now, I'm going to sue. It just seems like for people who don't have the patience for scratch tickets, or, you know, don't believe in those, it's just a new way to try to make money.
Well, so what do you think? I mean, of all the defendants, you just sue everybody and see if one sticks, and maybe you make a little money back on some of these legal costs. I mean, is it that simple? It does sound like a lottery, really.
I mean, that's probably what it is, right? That and hoping that, you know, some of the smaller ones or some of the ones that don't have quite the robust legal teams will just go ahead and settle for a small amount of money. Because how many are there? 15 or 16 companies?
Yeah, something like that.
So, I mean, get 10 of them to pay off and you've won, probably. You've beaten, I mean, you've exceeded your investment. And then maybe you fight more, you know, in court for longer periods of time, or maybe the rest of them just go ahead and settle too. I mean, Apple's been known to settle with some, right? If the amount of money is small.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely. Apple's certainly settled before, but Apple also has all of the money in the world to stay in litigation forever and ever, because, right, you know, we know that because we've been following it for the last year. I mean, just look at Apple and Samsung. It is very interesting, though, that it would be a patent that is related to basically the way that cell phones work. You know, hey, I'm closer to this cell station. Maybe we switch over to that one so that your phone actually works as you're walking through the world, because it's mobile after all. British Telecom says, we have nothing to do with this. You are on your own, Steelhead. Andy, do patent wars bring you at least a snicker, or is this just kind of noise?
Oh, I don't know. Until Disney makes a beloved animated feature in which a patent lawyer is the talking familiar to the plucky young heroine, I don't think that a patent lawyer will ever be a beloved or lovable creature. I mean, they did it with the raccoon, they did it with rats, they did it with all kinds of, you know, even insects, I think was the original Rescuers mover. There was a beloved mosquito. So it can be done, but I don't think short of that, anybody will find patent lawyers who'd file these kind of suits to be interesting or lovable people. And my eyes glaze over. My blood sugar drops 5 points. All kinds of things that I experience, none of them positive. And the worst thing is when these suits become so big and so newsworthy that now I have to actually learn about what the basis of this suit is, almost inevitably being told by an expert that, no, this is absolutely stupid, but yes, they've done their homework and they found a basis by which the suit can go forward. And it's going to be a case of who wants to back down first. And it's probably not going to be the patent troll, because the amount of money that they have to spend to keep this going forward is a fraction of what the people they're suing against have to spend to keep defending it. So it's just terrible.
Well, you know, I think what would be a lot more fun than this conversation is some of our picks of the week. And I realize that we want to quickly thank Audible first before we get into our picks of the week, because once the picks of the week are over, then we're done with this episode. So let's do that. Audible.com is the place for audiobooks. If you're wondering, okay, well, audiobooks, that sounds kind of interesting. I've never really listened to an audiobook before. I mean, how many are there really? There are over 100,000 titles. So there's a very good chance, unless you're a superhuman, that you will never get through half of them. Audible.com is the leading provider of audiobooks, downloadable titles across all types of literature. So this isn't just, you know, best-selling novels. Although, of course, they have all of those, but nonfiction, periodicals as well. And if you're a listener of MacBreak Weekly, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. So that's really cool. If you're not really sold on this whole idea of listening to a book rather than reading it, Audible says, well, we think you're going to like it. It's really kind of cool to have a book read to you. You know exactly how many hours you need to dedicate. You know, if you're a commuter, in a book, 17 hours, you can, you know, do a little math and go, okay, I can get through that book this week, you know, and then maybe I can join a book club or something next week type of a thing. So definitely take advantage of that. Andy, I know before the show you were saying, hey, is there an Audible ad today? Because I've got an Audible pick. So I'm going to throw it over to you. What are you reading, aka listening to, these days?
I just started a book by Jonathan Tropper called The Book of Joe. I started that about 3 or 4 days ago. Really funny first-person novel about an author who writes a novel that kind of scandalizes his hometown because he plucks a lot of stories from his childhood, figuring that, hey, look, I'm never coming back to this town again. So it's okay if I say these sort of things. And it becomes a huge bestseller, becomes a movie, and he becomes a successful author. But then, unfortunately, his dad has a stroke, forcing him to go back to his hometown and take care of his father and then face the music. So funny books. I haven't finished it yet. Funny book so far. Given that I go for a lot of nonfiction and a lot of heavy stuff, it's good to have a little bit of comedy going on.
Book of Joe. That's what it's called?
The Book of Joe.
The Book of Joe.
Based on the Book of Job, I'm sure, by Jonathan Tropper. And it's also it has the other attraction that I like, in that if it's a tie between two possible books that I'm thinking about making my next selection, like when I use my monthly credit, if it's the first book from somebody who's written a series of books, that gets my download, because if I really enjoyed the first one, that's great. Now I've got 3 or 4 more right behind it that I can go into right after that. So this is Tropper's second book. He himself says that he wrote the first one and then learned how to write with the second one. So I decided to skip over the first book and get right into the second, and I'm enjoying it a lot so far.
Very cool. That's awesome. It's always good to get a recommendation because, you know, it's you go 100,000 titles. On one hand, that's great. On the other hand, it can be a little overwhelming. So it's always nice to get a recommendation. If you're interested in getting your free book, want to download Book of Joe, then you and Andy can talk about it the next time you guys see each other at CES. Audible.com/MacBreak. That is audible.com/MacBreak. Okay, good. Now we're picks of the week. This is the fun part of the show. Not that the rest of, you know, patent litigation conversations weren't really, really fun. But Andy, do you want to start? I know you've got something called Air Login.
Yeah, this is a brand new app from Avatron Software. They make air sharing and that really great air display app that lets you use your iPad or your iOS device as an external display for Mac or Windows. Now they have their version of a VNC client. Air Login lets you really control your entire Mac from your iPhone or from your iPad anywhere in the world or anywhere off your local network. It's not by any means the first client app like this. There are a couple. I use an app called Screens that I really, really like. This is nice in that it seems to be really enhanced towards all the problems that you get when you try to control a computer that is usually controlled via a trackpad and a keyboard and use it with a device that has neither of those two things. So it's wired up with all kinds of really cool shortcuts that will put on-screen controls for the things you would normally like to have these sort of USB accessories for. Another kind of neat little trick where oftentimes the screen that you're mirroring onto your iPad isn't the same size as the iPad. Of course, it's usually much, much bigger, so you have to sort of scroll around it. They have a special feature where it'll just sort of grab the menu bar from whatever the frontmost application is and always reproduce it at the top of the iPad screen. So if you're typing, and now you want to export it out so you can save it to your Dropbox or something, and you're doing this on your iPad, you don't have to scroll to get back to your menu bar because the menu bar for that app will be right there at the top of your iPad screen. So it saves you a lot of futzing around, saves you a lot of scrolling around. The other cool thing about it is the way that they're pricing it. It is a free download. The full functionality of the app is absolutely free if you're going to be using it just to control a Mac on your home network. If you want to be able to use it to control your Mac from outside your home network, from your hotel rooms, coffee shops, whatever, then you have to buy a subscription, and it's a yearly subscription of $15 a year, which is comparable to what you would spend to own Screens or something outright. You can also buy month to month as you go access if you just think you want to need it, you want to use it for just 1 month, you just want to try it out. One catch, it's a strong enough initial release to make me recommend it. There are a couple, it's very much a 1.0. I think you can expect a 1.01 or 1.05 very, very shortly. There are a couple of bugs that I encountered over the weekend using it. But even in its initial 1.0 form, there is strong enough that I'm definitely here for the next release to see how well it works out.
Very cool. That's Air Login. That's Andy and Natko's pick of the week. Let's move over to you. Chris Breen. I know this one. What's your pick? I'll let you talk about it.
Okay. way back in the day, I used to review games for Computer Gaming World, and I was the Mac guy for them. And they had this application, this game they had, and they kind of looked at it and, you know, tried to play it on their Macs at the office, and they said, it's just some kind of picture book game or something. So let's give it to Breen because, you know, he'll figure out something to do with it. Well, it turns out to be this little game called Myst. And it was not the first game of its kind, but it was really the first compelling game of its kind, where you would walk through this virtual world and you would solve little puzzles as you went along. Well, there's now an iOS game called The Room, which is very much in the vein of Myst. This is where you actually come into this room and there are various boxes and devices there that you unlock through solving different kinds of puzzles. And it's very atmospheric. They have some wonderful music that goes with it. The graphics are tremendous. The puzzles aren't too terribly challenging, so that where you feel like you have to cheat. There's a little hint system built in, but it doesn't say, push that button, idiot. But rather, it's general enough that you have to think about it for a second and then move forward on it. Actually, I really like playing this game with my daughter at my side. So we each have our iPads with us, and we're both playing the game at the same time, and we kind of peek over at the other one and say, oh, did you find the that key with a little twisty thing on it? No. Oh, that's too bad. And then I'm moving on, and then she goes, oh, I found the twisty thing. And, oh, did you happen to find this little laser thing over here? No, how do you do that? Oh, you'll find it. So we sort of play this competitive game, even though it's not at all competitive, because there's no time-based element to it. You just kind of gently walk your way through the puzzles. It really is just gloriously rendered. They did a fabulous job, and it runs really well. I've been using it on my iPad mini as well as my 3G iPad. It's $2. I think right now it's the top-selling game at the App Store, and for good reason. It really is a fine effort. I look forward to seeing more of their work.
Yeah, this is a really nice game. Leo showed it off to me on iPad today a few weeks ago. It was recently, and he said the same thing. He said, "This is anybody who loves Myst. This is the game for you." And anybody who's not interested in, I don't know, so many of the games that are fast paced and exciting, but mm-hmm. Maybe just like a little bit, this is just really stressful. I'm one of those people. I love stuff like The Room because it's puzzle based and it's a thinking game.
Right.
All right, Ken, do you have a pick of the week as well?
I do. I feel kind of weird about my pick of the week, so I'm gonna strip the advertising part of it out. Squarespace is advertising on macOS, Ken, and that's not why I'm talking about this right now. I'm not going to give out the code or anything like that. I just started using them this week because they're advertising, and I'm so amazed at how easy it is to build websites with them. And that sounds like something you would just say if you were trying to advertise. But do me a favor, Chad, if you could click on the one that says social stuff up at the top. Oh, sorry. I'm just stunned by, okay, I did that in 5 minutes. Now, if I had taken more time, I'd probably have a little bit of a different look. But last night at about 4 a.m, I wanted to see, okay, what of my social stuff could I add and how long would it take? And to add my Twitter feed and my Instagram feed literally took 5 minutes. So it's not something that I've ever done before, and I've been really impressed with them. So that would be my pick if you're, thinking of starting your own, blog or, thing or whatever. And like I say, it feels weird because of the whole ad thing. But I'm just so amazed by how easy they make doing the stuff that they do. And I've been really turned on by that whole week.
Well, Squarespace is a Twit sponsor as well. And, and so obviously we talk about Squarespace all the time, but I'm with you, Ken. I've been using Squarespace long before I even worked here. And it's always amazed me at how easy it is, particularly with a lot of the social stuff when I'm not really mm-hmm. going to be blogging all that often. And I think, now I just have a stagnant site that I don't update. Well, I'm active on all sorts of other areas, and Squarespace is really good about bringing in, a variety of social widgets, I guess, for lack of a different word, to make up a page like that with no customization at all. You want to customize it, then it could look a million different ways.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I've had a website, and a friend of mine put together my website back in 2006, and it was really fantastic back in 2006. And honestly, it still does well, but he's gotten very busy, and I've needed to update, and I was like, well, I have to go out and find somebody because I won't know how to do it. Like I say, if I were more of a designer, I could have something that looked a little bit more polished, but that's me sort of like not being that much of a designer. The fact that I was able to replace the site that I've had for like 6 years or 7 years now with something that I made over a couple of hours and feel like, decent about it. It's crazy how easy it was. And I had a friend who tried to tell me about it like a year ago, year and a half ago. And I've heard you guys talk about it as well. And I feel stupid that I didn't, remake my site a year and a half ago when Clayton Morris actually was the first person that told me about it and told me how I should really just go ahead and do that. So thanks, Clayton. And about a year and a half later, I'm listening to you. So that's my pick.
Cool. MacOSKen.squarespace.com. You guys should go there and give him some feedback on his awesome site. Yeah, it's very easy to make a site. I'm actually in the process of trying to start a new blog. I don't even know what I'm going to do yet, but it's definitely going to be on Squarespace because I know it'll at least look good, even if my content is a little eh. All right, my pick of the week is actually something I talked about this on the latest episode of i5 of the iPhone, and I love it. As I mentioned, I'm not so crazy about a lot of the iOS games out there because they cause me a lot of stress and aggravation. And I like puzzle games, and I like games that on the surface seem like they have a very, very simple premise, but end up being kind of creative and addicting. And the latest game that I love is Hundreds. Hundreds came out, at least it's new to me, over the last week. And Jammerby, I don't know if you've got an overhead shot of my iPhone here. I should have just be running this on the iPad because that would have been a lot bigger. But if you have an overhead shot, I can show you. Otherwise, we can just look at the website. Okay, here we go. So, pay no attention to these dead trees here, but if you could, okay, so we're looking at, here's the game. You can only play it in landscape mode, which is actually makes perfect sense because it's a landscape kind of a game. The reason I love this is I will start at like level two. I'll start at level three, right? So you can see how easy this is. The object of the game, and I'll turn it on a little bit because it's kind of got nice music. I don't know how much you're going to hear of that. Start the round. The object is to get to 100. So you just hold on to these little circles here. They're kind of moving around, not that quickly. As you hold on to them, they turn red and they increase in number. You get to 100 and then you're done. And you might say, Sarah, that's the dumbest game in the world. Who would ever play that? Well, because it gets a lot harder. So that was level three. If I like jump over to level 13 here, I go ahead and start the round. And, oh, okay. Now we've got all sorts of stuff going on. Now, I've been playing this level already, so I know that because of the dotted line, these circles are now connected. So I have to hold on to the circles at the same time in order to increase my numbers. And it's hard to do at this angle. So pardon me for being a terrible player right now. Now, the reason that it didn't work is because when two circles touch each other, they say when they touch and they're red, then you are dead. So you have to be really careful about while you're growing your circles, not to touch your circles until they turn gray again after you take your finger off. This is a really fun game, and I am a terrible, terrible game model, but I love it. This is $3. And part of the reason that I like the game so much is that it's designed so well. I don't know why I'm having such a hard time with this. Well, shoot. All right. See, I'm having a hard time with level 13. I've been having a hard time for a long time. If we go back to, like, level 6. Ooh, okay, here's a bubble level. This is kind of fun. So, oh, now, see, I'm red. Because I touched and the bubbles. So this is a lovely game. It's getting a lot of attention from people who are interested. I'm going to turn off this music because it's very distracting. Interested in games that the design is, yeah, it's really polished and it just looks like, it's just perfect for iOS. I kind of like that stuff too. I think I first heard about Hundreds on Tumblr, which is where I hear about all the cool design stuff in my world. So I'm pretty addicted to it. I know a few other folks who are. I think that it has a particular look. The number part of it is kind of fun. It's very easy to pick up. There's not a big learning curve here, but you will get stumped. You got 100 levels, and it's like I'm sort of stuck on number 15, and I keep going back to it because I really like this stuff. But you give it a try. You know, if you've got $3 to spare, and you're looking for a game that, in my opinion, is not, you know, it's not a shoot 'em up or you know, it's not going to cause you a lot of stress and aggravation, definitely check it out. Has anyone else here played Hundreds?
Not yet.
Well, I suggest you try it out because I think you'll like it. It's really fun. Good music's good too. Yeah. All right. So that's my pick. Well, here are we. We're at 1:09 p.m. Gosh, you guys, we've been going for 2 hours solid because we started almost right after 11 Pacific. So I'll remind everybody who might be watching after the fact, thanks to everybody who joined us live. But if you're not watching live, this show, Mac Break Weekly, records Tuesdays, 11 a.m. Pacific time, 2 p.m. Eastern time. It's a lot of fun. Obviously, Leo Laporte is in CES, at CES. That is why I am filling in for him this week. So thanks to everybody who suffered through me and my CES coverage haze. He will be back in the hot seat next week with a wonderful panel. But I want to say thanks to everybody who was on the panel this week. Andy Anatko, of course, tech columnist at Chicago Sun-Times.
Chris, do I have to go through the whole tutorial or should I just get right into the game?
Jump right in there.
Oh, man, this does look awesome. Ooh, wow, floating. Ooh. I've just found a key. Awesome.
I was about to ask Andy. What's new in your world? But I think I have my answer. That's what you're going to be debating for the next week.
I've got plans for the next 72 hours. Thank you very much.
But besides that, anything you want to talk to us about stuff you're working on?
I've got my traditional annual remote CES coverage coming up. First piece hitting the web sometime later today about the Qualcomm keynote and basic larger themes that are they're leaping up. And I'll probably have two more follow-up pieces as the week goes by. Landing with on Friday a piece where here's all the random little interesting bibs and bobs that I encountered, was press released about, was emailed about, was talking to someone else about, and found interesting enough to at least put half a paragraph down on paper about.
Excellent. Chris Breen, thank you so much for being a part of our show today. Senior editor over at Macworld. What do you got going on? Anything you want to talk about or plug?
Sure, because I probably won't be on before then. At the upcoming Macworld Expo, which is now called Macworld iWorld, I'm going to be interviewing Fred Armisen from Portlandia.
Yes!
And Saturday Night Live. And I'll also be interviewing one of my favorite musicians, a guy named Blue, B-L-E-U, who's sort of does this amazing pop work, and he's written for Demi Lovato and some other great artists, a wonderful musician himself. And I'll be doing a couple of other sessions at Macworld iWorld as well. So I hope to see you and everybody else there.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't know. Leo and I haven't even really talked about our plans for Macworld, but we're absolutely going to be going. Can I just ask, is the Fred Armisen interview, is it music related? Because I know, although he's an extremely funny comedian, he got his start in music, and I know he's really interested in the music tech side of things.
Right. It's he was a drummer in a punk band.
Yeah.
Originally. So the focus of it is supposed to be on technology and what he does with tech, because his dad worked at IBM. And my understanding is he's kind of a geek. But because of all the other interesting things he does and the fact that I'm a musician, I am going to talk to him about music and how it relates to technology and his writing and his comedic work, as well as Portlandia. It's an amazing show, and I want to talk a lot about that stuff as well. So it's going to be very far-reaching. There'll be some tech, but we'll talk about all kinds of stuff.
Oh, that's amazing. Look forward to that. Ken Ray, host and producer at Mac OS Ken, and now the the proud developer of a wonderful website. Ken, what's on tap for the next week or two?
3 weeks, I guess it is, Macworld. This is like camp for me every year. I'm very excited. I get less work done during the week of Macworld than I do any other time of the year, because I just, you know, go and see all the podcasters that I spend all the time talking to remotely. Although I do have actually big plans this year. I'm going to stalk Chris Breen in the hopes of running into Fred Armisen. So
I hope it all works out for you.
Thank you very much. Fingers crossed.
Absolutely. Thanks to all three of you for being part of the show today and helping me hobble along through MacBreak Weekly. This is by far the most intimidating show. I don't know what my problem is, but I always just, you know, I want to do good by the audience and the community. So thanks to everybody for watching and listening. This is the end of episode 332. Actually, I think I said 331 at the beginning of the show. 332, recorded on January 8th, 2013. You can, of course, follow the show, subscribe to the show at twit.tv/MBW. That is the mothership of all MacBreak Weekly shows. Want to go back a few shows? You can watch the video right there. It's everything. Everything is there. So thanks to Andy Anatko, Christopher Breen, and Ken Ray for being with me. And now, if I can channel Leo for a second, break time's over. Get back to work.